This is the podcast version of the YouTube series, From Here to the Stars, which is created by the Interstellar Research Group. I am your host, Stephen Ewan Cobb. Our guest today is Dr. Charles E. Gannon, author of a number of national best-selling novels of hard science fiction. I have the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Charles E. Gannon. He is most famous for being an author of many national best-selling hard science fiction novels, but he has also been a scriptwriter and producer in New York City, where his clients included the United Nations, the World Health Organization, and PBS. He was also a distinguished professor of English and Fulbright senior specialist. Indeed, he received 5 Fulbright fellowships and travel grants. He has also been a subject matter expert, both for national media venues, such as NPR and the Discovery Channel, as well as for various intelligence and defense agencies, including the Pentagon, Air Force, Army, Marines, Navy, NATO, DHS, DARPA, and NASA. I want to ask about many of these, but I want to start with, you've participated in the IRG's symposium, the Interstellar Research Group. Why are the goals of the IRG important to you personally?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me here. Hello to all the fellow travelers who are no doubt watching. I doubt you've come along here and just said, "Oh, I'll just push on this button and see what happens." My guess is it's a self-selected audience, and that's actually kind of a segue to an answer, which is why I write what I write and why I work and what I work is largely defined by I loved it from, as early as I knew that there was space. And when you're growing up in the 60s, you know there was space. It was just a first love. And in a sort of more, I guess you would say, adult answer, a couple of quotes come to mind. Tsiolkovsky's quote about, you know, Earth, the cradle of humanity, but you better not stay there. And obviously, the more we look out into the heavens and understand that the Gulf of Mexico is probably, you know, signs that maybe not all the big rocks are probably gone. The idea of thinking about what we're going to be, that we're not there's a tendency to think that the day in which we live is the pinnacle of all things. Nothing could be more wrong, and nothing has been more frequently disproven by history, whether old or contemporary or new, so to speak. I can't remember his name. He appeared, his last name began with K, and he was asked in a congressional subcommittee why he was so interested in rockets. This was like in the 48, 49. They said, all this future stuff. And he said, why are you interested? And he said, I'm interested in the future because it's where I'm going to spend the rest of my life. And if it's not my life, it's the life of my actual or children or everybody's children. And if one has, I think, a conscientious outlook on us as individuals, as a species, and all the various subdivisions in between, I think being interested in the future, which to me is synonymous with being interested in space, if we want to expand, it's been part of a very cohesive whole, at least in my brain.
You wrote a nonfiction book by the title of Rumors of War and Infernal Machines, Techno-Military Agenda Setting in American and British Speculative Fiction, which, by the way, is based on your it rolls off the tongue. Which is based on your doctoral thesis. If you would summarize for the viewers what that book is about.
The very quick version is when I was writing that, there was and there remains a species of postmodern, I would say, doubt about the efficacy of narrative. That's essentially what deconstruction was all about. And I really felt that was not the case. I'd felt narrative influence my life. I'd seen it influence others. And this was, of course, my great love, the future and technology. And so I went and I looked for evidence that it had taken place. And it turned out that this project, which at the outset I was told this will be very difficult, was about as difficult as dynamiting goldfish in a bathtub. It was the amount of evidence in late Victorian and Edwardian England of their use of narratives, which we've forgotten, but that actually got into their war office and influenced a whole lot of designs, not just the tank, which a lot of people know about, but radio telegraphy, actually, if you will, robotic ammunition carriaging systems that were used in World War I to move supplies across, so people didn't have to pop out of trenches. They used essentially a sort of chain conveyor belt. And all of these sort of things and ultralight planes were envisioned. And when you move across, it's kind of interesting how almost as the torch sort of passed from Great Britain to the United States, as I guess you could say, one of the world's leading powers, that same impulse to look at the future came with it. And the amount of influence that is in that book that is pretty meticulously, it is meticulously researched, but it is not complete. There is so much. All I can say is that if you leaf through the book, you're going to find one of my favorites, which is apparently from Northrop Grumman. It was at a presentation done inside the five-sided squirrel cage that most people call the Pentagon. And it was about the size of what the B-2 bomber was going to be. So first they show it next to, I think, a B-52. Then they show it next to something like an aircraft carrier. And after that, they show it how many it would take to go across the disk of the original series Enterprise. And then the new era Enterprise. Mm-hmm. And next generation, I guess. And here's the thing about that. Nobody in the room, A, was confused. And B, no one thought it inappropriate. That tells you something about the headspace of the people who are working in classified domains. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was, like I said, it was the amount of evidence of this is just extraordinary. There has been a huge influence from narrative going to military and technological thought, but then actually in many ways, it's what is made and news and symposia and things like that actually sort of feeds it back to authors because we want to stay up on this sort of stuff. So there's a loop in there which was really interesting to discover and work with.
I don't have the page count for the book that's publicly available, but your thesis runs almost 900 pages.
A lot of that thesis was chopped away. It was simply not necessary for it. And I wrote the thesis that way, the dissertation. I knew I was going to get rid of the theory part. I knew I was going to get rid of a lot of the preliminary and sort of peripheral parts that had more to do with media and semiotics and things like that. And I just knew that this was the one I was going to. Okay. I had the core that was going to go there. And it's still available. It won the American Library Association Choice Award in 2003, I believe.
Okay.
So one or the other.
Yeah, I found online the first portion of it and then printed out the table of contents. But I also printed out the table of contents for the book that's available on Amazon.
Right.
And that has the long title that comes trippingly to the tongue.
Yes. Rumors of War and Infernal Machines. And then there's a colon and all that other stuff. And as certain academics who are willing to engage in self-deprecatory humor says, you know what comes after the colon. Well, it's the same thing in titles. So at any rate, yes, Rumors of War and Infernal Machines. That's okay. The part that definitely works for you.
Okay. Chapter 4 of that book. H.G. Wells, the far future war prophet of Edwardian England. Pretty much everybody has read his novels, seen the movies that were from the novels. It seemed to me that he was, because it was, you know, I mean, we see that, we view it from today's basis compared to other science fiction novels and such. But at the time, he was remarkably innovative in his devices and tactics. If you would talk a little bit about how some of that worked its way into warfare.
Oh, well, wow. Where do I begin? First of all, he wrote a book. The books that are probably in some ways the most influential are not the ones that most people know about. The one that's more easily accessible probably, or well, I shouldn't say easily accessible because it's harder to find, but it predicts air combat and the nature of strategic air combat. And it's called The War in the Air. And it's written, I want to say, it's early, it's either the early 1900s or the very late years of the 1800s. And there are lighter than aircraft in there, but for the most part, that's not what it's dealing with. It's dealing with heavier than aircraft and how they are going to change the face of war. And you got to remember that in 1914, when World War I began, they didn't even have guns that shot through propellers with synchronization gears. They had to mount them on top of the wing. They had to do all this other stuff. And he is just leaping far beyond that, and the capability of aircraft to sink battleships, totally unheard of. And of course, even 20 years later, Billy Mitchell was going to get essentially run out on rails because he proposed that. And it took until World War II until the notion of a carrier-based strike would do the job. But probably, to my mind, the more influential one, and people knew it was influential, was The World Set Free, which is a very interesting title because it's about the development of atomic energy, but mostly atomic weapons. He didn't get all the specifics right, but he certainly got right the idea of a dead zone after. He foresaw the incredibly destabilizing capability of miniaturization of these. Not only is he the first person to write about a nuclear weapon, he takes it to the level of essentially what we would call a suitcase nuke, and how it was, and this required something that was going to be a world organization. At the end of World War II, there was something actually floated called the Baruch proposal, which was about a kind of a global consensus on this, but the peacekeeping was going to be done by a very select number of powers. Well, this was exactly the proposition that was at towards the end of The World Set Free. That obviously did not fly for all sorts of reasons, but its influence on individuals. Leo Szilard, who is in many ways considered the person who really sort of was behind critical mass reaction that would actually be weaponizable, said that it was because he'd read that book and then watched, strangely enough, a traffic light change. And so, and it was the nature of the transition of the colors. And for some reason that kicked off something that he read in the book, and he said, yes, it can be done. Now, lest one thinks that that's, totally pointless, Szilard obviously has a lot of, you take a look at his name and take a look at the people who are on the Manhattan Project, and you're going to see an awful lot of overlay. And there were only two books that were required reading for the people who went into the Manhattan Project, and World Set Free was one of them.
Okay. So, just out of curiosity, what was the other? Do you remember?
The what?
Do you remember the other one?
No, I don't. I think it was a sort of the equivalent of a 1920s version of an air power story. Mm-hmm. So I think what was going on was basically, here's the weapon, here's the delivery system. We're not just fooling around here. This is on the way. Somebody's going to get here first. It damn well better be us.
Okay. Well, now my admiration for H.G. Wells has gone through the ceiling.
he was quite impressive. I think the sad thing is that he became so concerned with where he saw the world going, is that when you get past his, what he would call his scientific romances, he gets a little bit more didactic. I think he was proselytizing because he saw all sorts of problems on the horizon. Mm-hmm. And so those aren't his better known books, but they are certainly worth a read.
Okay. Yeah. And it's still very approachable. For the opening scene of The Time Machine, it lays it out really clearly. It's beautiful.
Oh yeah. Yeah. He wasn't the engineer that, for instance, Verne was. Mm-hmm. But as is often the case, engineering is bounded by the conventions of the day and a little bit of extrapolation. Mm-hmm. Wells, of course, went wild, or so they thought, mm-hmm. and actually, he might, you say, have the, he remains something other than quaint. Mm-hmm. Although I think that Verne now kind of reads as amazing that he saw it, but quaint.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's see. Later in the book, you have chapter 9, Making Man Machines of Mass Destruction, Future War Authors as Seers in an Age of Cyborg Soldiers. We're beginning to see this a bit on the battlefield. If you would talk a little bit about that.
Well, when the book was being written, I once again, it was sort of like, it was as easy as falling off a log. And because at that point, there was something called, it was Future Soldier was what it was called, but mm-hmm. there was also the Future Combat System, FCS. This was sort of being floated around in the mid 90s. And it was not doable. There, if you go back, you can find this sort of stuff, and you can find smart munitions that knew to go through a window, for instance, an open window, and explode on the other side if they detected heat signatures and things like this. And actually, some of these got developed. There was a very advanced weapon system that combined that launcher with a pretty mundane version of the AR-15 or the M4, I guess you would say. And it was a completely, the helmet was slave to a computer on the back. You could take a look at where you were, look relevant to others. It was an armor carrying system. You were sort of naturally plugged into a laser designation system for fire and forget missiles. And all of this stuff actually performed pretty well. It wasn't as rugged as it might want to be, but the problem was it was way too heavy. Mm-hmm. Well, if you take a look, if you were to go back into the archives and look at what Future Soldier looked like in, let's say, 1996, and you look like, I have a son right now who's in the Rangers, first Bat Rangers out of Savannah, Georgia. And the stuff he's got is that. It's just that rather than go through a whole suit, they were playing with pieces. I think some of the people thought, yeah, we're going to be able to do this. Usually what happens, from what I've been able to see, is a bunch of ideas get tested out. And they are ambition and insight precedes engineering. And you have some people who are so gung-ho about it, they actually think it's going to be realized in that first iteration. Usually not. Lessons are learned. And because people had that sort of money to throw at it, R&D, it does two things. It perhaps awakens corporate types who would have never envisioned that these things might be valuable and say, I wonder if we could get a defense contract out of it. Of course, you put that down to the people who are working in the labs and saying, you know, this would be useful for EMTs. This would be useful for people on the street. And you wind up now, we're talking about the metaverse. It is not a straight line in the sense that there aren't some jinks and wiggles in the path, but this idea of miniaturizing elements that wearables, I guess you is the best way to say it. When you go back to 1895, I date myself, 1995, the notion of wearables is really something that you find married to the hip at some, I would say, very good hard SF. And the other part, you're going to find it as kind of an adjunct to cyberpunk. You know, it's sort of hovering in that area. Well, here we are, not 30 years later, and where would you be without your cell phone? Where would you be without your Bluetooth headset? Where would you, at you know the list. I'm not going to burn up airtime. Well, that's really a way in which what was going on then was actually being done, and it had been influenced. You take a look at the influences. Heinlein, Starship Troopers, any science fiction writer who talked about a hard suit was sort of, because that was another part, which, by the way, DARPA is still looking at, which are, you know, exoskeletons for a variety of purposes. But there was also stuff like Steve Sterling had in some of his fiction regarding, if you will, a very quick semi-neural interface with firearms and things of that nature, the idea of targeting and how that you could slave that with various kinds of refinements so that human, you know, the human eye is not what's dealing with windage anymore. It's a computer that can measure things at range. So all of that stuff, that's just a wave top touch on that. But that's what that chapter was looking at.
Okay. In my intro, I mentioned that you were a subject matter expert for media and government agencies. What subjects did you advise them about? For example, the Pentagon, DARPA, NASA?
We don't have that much time.
I know.
everything from the respective values of single stage to launch vertical, runway to runway. Do we want to put something at L2? What would it be? Which when that conversation was first had with Les Johnson some time ago, it was a great answer in search of a question. But I think Les and others were very foresightful. And I think people like Jack McDivitt and Nancy Kress and Rob Sawyer were on that phone call also. And now, of course, we're realizing that we're going to need those Lagrangian points as waypoints. Their value at that time was not evident. Well, it's getting pretty evident now. Yeah. And so so once again, it's another one of those moments where you're talking about something and people are looking. There are, and thank God there are devotees of the idea who would love to make it real right now. Usually doesn't happen that way. Because usually because the foresightful mind gets way ahead of the infrastructure that will make it cost, that allows you to do it cost effectively. But then one day the technology is caught up and all of a sudden it's like, man, that was a pretty bright idea, wasn't it? But I'll make it my own this time. You know, it's that sort of thing. The politicians love doing that. So do people in all organizations. And but these ideas have been out there, and that's one example. A lot of the stuff, I've signed a lot of NDAs, so I can't talk about them. I will say that I have been involved in the difference on issues regarding automation on the battlefield, whether the autonomy of drones or not. I will tell you right away that I will, and this is just an opinion. You can see this in my books. I am highly suspicious of putting weapons on fully autonomous systems. Not because I think that Skynet is going to take them over and do something, although I think that a threat state, you know, whoever's got the better hackers and may know something that you don't about your own systems, you're asking for trouble. But I think the other thing is that the ability, trusting a machine to distinguish the difference between a path used by, let's say, insurgents versus a path that kids run down to the waterhole with. You don't do that with a machine. That's hard for humans. And it's based on experience and an eye for nuance. Mm-hmm. So it's really run the gamut. It's been huge fun. I have one of the things I've tried to do as soon as I think of something, I try to put it in a book. So that then I don't have problems having somebody come back to me, you know, and say, wait a minute, you've broken your NDA, got there first, which actually became a kind of thing at the National Reconnaissance Office. I had to sort of politely demur being involved in a project because I called up my friend, the late and great Jerry Purnell, because Jerry, of course, was involved in these sort of things. And I called him and I said, Jerry, I got to ask you, I mean, they're not giving me a lot of details on how long I'd have to sit on something while they vet it. And he said, do you want to be involved in that, you know, in that advising realm, or do you want to be an author? And I said, I want to be an author. It's what I am. And he said, then don't do it. And I said, that's what I thought. So, yeah, it's been a great ride. And every once in a while, I still get to go out and
When the mysterious black ships arrived, they devastated humanity's peaceful space settlements and obliterated their populations. Earth appears defenseless against the mysterious marauders. Two of humanity's finest starship captains must push themselves to the brink to save humanity from total annihilation by an enemy that will not identify itself or reveal its motives. Together, they will plumb the scientific wells of existence where the primordial knot of space-time may be unraveling. The Space-Time War by Les Johnson and BaneBooks.com.
And write it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, excellent. I really admire Jerry Pournelle. I interviewed him one time after reading a few of his books, and it was he set a record for all my interviews. He went the longest. He went 2 hours and 17 minutes. It was
Jerry. You got a lot to say.
And he still had plenty to talk about, but you know, he was getting up in years a little bit and it pooped him out. So, but you know, hats off to Jerry Pournelle.
Absolutely.
Yeah. My next question is, humans have had a long history of war. Do you anticipate armed conflict occurring in space before the end of this century? And I think I know the answer, but I'll let you answer it.
That actually goes very close to NDA. I don't know if you're familiar with the Office of Net Assessment.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds really like it would be actuarial or computer, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's not. Office of Net Assessment was essentially, and still is to this day, and had been overseen since its inception under the Nixon administration by one guy, Andrew Marshall, for whom there's a foundation now. And it was, if you will, a kind of, it was an institutionalized think tank, but based on really rigorous sort of assessments of everything from economies to technology to strategic evolution to cultural evolution and change. And so I've had reason to be there to talk about this very thing you're asking.
Mm-hmm.
Will we have armed conflict in space? Well, if armed conflict means is as broad as something does something destructive to something else on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Will we know it? Will we be able to prove it? Will anybody admit to it? That's a much different question. I kind of suspect we've already had it happen.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's a will it. I think it's a matter of when does this. You know, there's an awful lot of confidence in certain kinds of systems right now.
Mm-hmm.
And they're testing lasers on, you know, this has been going on since what, for almost 15 years, that it's like, can we paint it with a laser? Can we burn something with a laser?
Mm-hmm.
Because you think they're going to do that to cut glass on the moon? No, I don't think that's what they're up to.
Mm-hmm.
If what you mean by armed combat is human beings actually engaged with each other, I hope not. I wouldn't be surprised. And that actually tags into some of my own fiction, simply because there's a couple of components that I want to throw on the table, and probably a lot of people will see the connections between them right away. There's that thing I was talking about, autonomy in drones. And right now, most of what we do is remote control, right? But remote control or autonomy or some combination of the two. However, if you can't trust the autonomy fully, you really need the remote control, right? But remote control only moves as fast as light. Now you may say, who cares about that? Well, let's see. If you go to the moon, that's, I think, what, one light second, right? Just about 300,000 kilometers, 186,000 miles per second. So it's right about at that spot, convenient for measuring. Well, one can certainly see lots of reasons why the moon would be either just because of its astrospatial orientation or possible assets on it, why there might be some elbows out sort of attitudes on the moon in the future. Well, what if it's on the far side? And right now, talk to anybody in, for instance, missile intercept or things like that about how long a second is. A second is, forget it. A second means the laser, which can travel at the speed of light, is problematic enough. But you have to get, you know, you have to get the signal to you, Moon, 1 second. Now you have to make a decision. Let's say you have an automated AI assistant that says, do this, and you do it, half a second. Now, another second till it goes out, and then the system activates. 2.5 seconds. You are dead. That speed is not sufficient. Human beings, the way I look at it, and it shows up in my fiction, for you to really make nuanced decisions, both for the purposes of safety and optimal tactical application, you don't want to be more than a quarter of a light second away from the objects you're controlling. Mm. If you are, even with assisted AI, I think you're pushing the envelope. Mm-hmm. So that is the reason this whole spiel is. So if that's the case, if that makes sense, and human beings are going to be within a quarter of a light second in order to ensure timely response, I don't see how we don't have, as the astronauts called it during the Mercury phase, spam in the can out there. I don't think it's going to be the first phases. I don't think they're going to be guys jumping or gals jumping around in spacesuits with M16s. I don't know what the future beyond holds, but I think that it's difficult to see an unpopulated space in a sort of military environment.
Okay. let's see. Let me just skip the next couple of questions. What are some of the key differences between war on Earth and war in space?
Wow.
And is that another NDA?
Pardon me?
And is that another NDA?
No, I mean, that's simple physics, right? There's also the difference of war in space as it even is sort of conducted as drills now is entirely different from what you see on, for instance, beams, right? Unless they're plasma, unless they're emitting light, the only way you're going to see a laser, you'll know that most of the viewers probably know this, is if it's passing through some sort of vapor or plasma and is essentially, you know, the light's getting split off, or you're looking down the barrel, so to speak. Well, if you're looking down the barrel, you may see it, but you may not report it. But you're dealing with a kind of physics that is so counterintuitive in so many ways. Go faster to go higher, you know, but sometimes go down and go faster to go higher. You know, it's like there's so many things having to do with just simple orbital mechanics. How do you actually come to a meeting engagement? Okay, and now I'm talking about craft. You know, unless you're actually sort of tracking each other in passes by staying in close to a planet, which actually planets have a high probability, I think, of being like Thermopylae, like the Bosphorus, you know, they are going to be the choke points, not merely because that's where people are, but because actually they are, first of all, they're going to be way stations for resources, even if they're uninhabitable. You might say, why go to Jupiter? Well, I'll tell you one reason. Build a gas station on Europa, you know, because there's water there. That's going to be pretty easy to crack. You're not going to have to leach it out of the lunar various, the regolith and other components there that you're hoping, you know, with application you can get that from. But there's also the fact that playing with gravity allows you to actually make multiple passes and to also change where you might come. So let's imagine, this is highly simplistic, two forces going around the equator. And so every time they do a half orbit, they're meeting again. Then you can get into the fact that, do they boost high? Do they boost low? Has one broken off? Does one accelerate to pop out of orbit? There are a lot of opportunities for tactics that are a little more sophisticated. In free space, well, let's see. You don't want to be lollygagging on your way in, because if you're going slow, you're easier to hit. That's just the way. But the problem is, then there's this little thing of counterboosting. So as much as you want to head in quickly and present as a target that is, Yeah, I'm going to get a vector on you, obviously. I'm going to get your trajectory, but if you're going really quickly and jinking even a little bit, you know, if I'm trying to deposit laser energy on you for 0.2 seconds, can I? If a missile is trying to get to you, does that give it, how wide does its interception and calculation cone have to be to make sure that it doesn't get tricked at the last second? Algorithms dueling with algorithms, as it were. Now take that into free space, and there's this, it's like, I think it's kind of like a joust between people on rocket motorcycles. Mm-hmm. They're going to get one pass, and you probably want it for two reasons, because you won't know the outcome until the outcome is going, the engagement, if it's actually a passing, a meeting engagement, is going to be so rapid that you're going to be, it's going to be, things happened, damage control, do we think we're better off than they are? And anyhow, we're both heading in this direction. And unless I'm really confident, do I really want to then tumble, counter boost, try to catch up? There's this notion of fleets meeting in the middle of space. The real issue is going to be if you can't find essentially a matched kind of closing vector, and you're actually trying to not spend a lot of time because you don't know, you don't want to spend a lot of time because what if they got something you don't know, right? It's going to be single passes and long drifts.
Mm. Okay, interesting.
And then of course we've got zero G and don't puncture your vac suit and Coriolis effect in trying to aim and it goes on and on. And you can read my books and see all of this in action.
Right, speaking of your books, in your book, in your series, Tales of the Terran Republic, the first book title is Fire with Fire, which, by the way, is currently free on Amazon in ebook form. The story is set
on Bain's website as well.
Is it really? Okay. The story is set approximately 80 years in the future at a time when humanity has colonized other star systems. However, the propulsion system is, to my mind, a little unconventional. Describe it, if you would, the propulsion system.
The propulsion system, if you take a look in the first page, the dedication to that book, one of the dedications is to Ian Tregellis. He is another Sigma member. You probably know him. He's Livermore, I think, with the Fusion Project.
I've heard of him. Interviewed him.
So what happened was I was looking at this drive. I don't call it fast. People call it faster than light because it's the same, because it's the handle that got used. It is, however, there is acceleration involved, but not for the reason that most would do. The reason I bring up Ian is because I wanted to say, take a look at this and tell me what you think. You know, what am I doing here? And so I waited and I waited. 2 weeks went by and I said, oh my God, I'm sure he doesn't want to tell me that this is just total crap. And so I sent him an email and I'll never forget his response. He said, no, I've been geeking out on it. I was like, okay, that sounds like a good sign. And as he said, it doesn't violate anything. It is different. It is not push a button. And there's a whole bunch of stuff behind that I don't know that we'll have. Actually, that was one of, if I made a list of the logical sequence of maybe things to talk about, the most basic things that, for instance, IRG would be concerned with, like long duration habitation in space. To my mind, a supraluminal, which is what this is called, a supraluminal drive was at the end as incredibly speculative. So on the one hand, while I would not call myself a devotee of string theory exactly, I will say, well, first of all, the problem with string theory is not that it's provably wrong, it's that you can't prove it at all. I mean, its manifestations are beyond our ability to create any sort of analytical tool, any sort of empirical measurement of. However, one of the things that, of course, is tempting about it is that it does reconcile an awful, the entire spooky action at a distance that you know Papa Einstein left us with, does some interesting work with that. And we don't have good explanations for that. I can always enrage physicists if I'm a little waggish and some have taken me seriously and I say, so observer effect, does that mean that by definition you believe in God? What? No, quite the contrary. I said, well then who was there to observe it at the start? You know, now, granted, I'm being waggish, as I said, but it's illustrative, I think, because the standard model still is having to jump through an awful lot of hoops. My suspicion is that 50 years or 100 years from now, people will be looking at it kind of the same way maybe that you know, after Einstein, you start looking at Newton, say, good try. Or even Ptolemaic astronomy, if we go far enough out there, which was, you got to hand it to Ptolemaic astronomy. They made everything work, right? Mm-hmm. Everything showed up just when it should. They had perfectly good explanations that sometimes it involved flying turtles or whatever the case may be. It was a little bit, you know, far-fetched, but not to them. And they got it all down right. And when you've got something that answers most of observed phenomena, it certainly builds a great deal of confidence. So this is based on a component of string theory, which is essentially that as you move objects to higher energy states, which is what we see, you know, that's what you do if you want to generate that sort of, if you will, quantum jump, or what they at one point called electron tunneling, or you know, just the uncertainty principle, meaning that anything has a greater than zero chance of being anywhere in creation at any given moment. Finding a way to exploit that. And there are two ways. One is a field effect, which is essentially a kind of, I use the term an incipient event horizon. It is creating the equivalent of a blip that's almost like what would create a black hole, but it's not enough to sustain. It creates a deformation of space. It creates a deformation of space at a place which, if you have enough knowledge of, if you have their knowledge of string theory, there's no fast answer to this except to say that supposedly all things are entangled, right? It's just the degree of entanglement depends on proximity at creation or you know, how far back we go. Well, by that notion, stars in the same cluster would probably be more entangled than, let's say, stars compared to a galaxy 200 million light years away. Mm-hmm. So once you can measure that, then the question is, can you find optimal places where, if you will, whatever connects, whatever creates entanglement, can you find the time, space, moment, or I should say volume, to say there, that's where we're going to drop that effect. But that's not all there is. If you tried to do that with a standing craft, unless you are much more advanced in this technology, you just generate junk, you know, protoatomic junk coming out the other side. So there's an acceleration component. The acceleration component is not to go, it's not even to go fast, to go through this momentary like clip. It's to move, and this was what Ian really liked about it. It's to change the entire energy state of all the mass in the moving object. Because because the resistance to these sort of transitions usually is the current energy state of the object that you're applying the force to. Mm-hmm. Well, to make it easier, you raise the energy state of the entire object, in this case, the craft. Wow. It is, however, fantastically expensive to do. Mm-hmm. And actually, the numbers behind how the energy is produced and where it's produced is all there. It's only hinted at in the series. I do the math, so you don't have to, but the math has been done, and it's actually, I'm happy to talk with people about it. And it involves the moon at first, and it involves antimatter. And as I know you guys are aware, you get almost 24/7 light at Shackleton and Perry, the lunar poles. Now I want you to think about what it's like. It's that old notion of save a penny a day, right? How soon are you a millionaire? People say, well, how are you going to make antimatter is not a resource. Antimatter is essentially a storage medium. Absolutely true. So then the question becomes, where do you find free energy? Well, actually, there's an awful, when there's no atmosphere in the way, there's an awful lot of energy hitting the moon. There's even more hitting Mercury, et cetera, et cetera. The question is, can you capture it and can you transition it? And there have been some very interesting advances made in both the capturing and the storage of antimatter. So I pay attention to how do you get the energy density and where do you go to do it? What technology do you have? And it is based on stuff that was not off the shelf, but you know, solar panels have been around a long time. And I remember in 1995, people would talk about what is the, you know, this is the maximum theoretical efficiency, which we have long since blown past. Mm-hmm. So just, you know, that's a really, really quick tour of, there is an interstellar drive. It is expensive. It is infrequent. It's big. And therefore you do not have a lot of ships zipping around. At the time that it's about actually 95 years in the future is really when it starts. There's an earlier, there's a sort of prelude, I think, that you're probably referring to, at which point they haven't done this. They're on the cusp of it. You can only have a handful of these ships because they're just simply the immense cost and the amount, immense engineering. And of course that gets into why would anybody go there? That's a whole other interview, right?
Okay. In all fiction, there is no story until something goes wrong or is discovered to already be wrong. In your stories, what usually goes wrong? Is it a person, a technology, an accident, sabotage, misunderstanding, or something else altogether? Or is there even a pattern to it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm not sure there's a pattern. I will say this much. Almost always. So I enjoy narratives that deal with how do humans deal with force majeure, right? And it can be instructive, but it starts us in a sort of position of the agency of reaction only, in a sense. Something happens, now we have to do something about it to survive or to ameliorate it, whatever the case may be. I find that in human or even more than human affairs, the trip is always in the phrase, the law of unintended consequences. That is usually where I start. To give you a sense of where the entire series starts off. And the only reason, by the way, that we're able to fund this drive to get out there is because something called the Doomsday Rock is detected coming in 2080. And we're fortunate because we've just been starting to look back at space, and we've got a drive that's actually at that point, the drive is related to, Slough, S-L-O-U-G-H. He created, I know Edwards Air Force Base they cut metal on it. There was a small scale version that actually demonstrated in Milan. This goes back to turn of the century. It's like 2001, it's more recent than that. It's like 2009, 2010. And essentially what you're looking at is it, Jean-Luc Cambier?
Yeah, I've read about him.
Okay, Jean-Luc was one of the people who was looking at this out in Edwards. Mm-hmm. And this is essentially, you're talking about a magnetic bottle containing heated plasma, heavier particle plasma. You need a nuke on board. So obviously in those days, politically, it was a non-starter. We'll find out about that as time goes on. But it had enough of an ISP for them to get out there and knock this thing off course. There's one little problem about this, what they call the Doomsday Rock. The Doomsday Rock was a very strange item because it apparently didn't come from the asteroid belt. It came out of the Oort cloud or the Kuiper belt. But it was something that's not very common out there, which is it seemed to be very heavy. It had a lot of metal elements in it. It was also heading in at a retrograde orbit on a retrograde course, all of which was therefore in hindsight, not particularly shocking when the people who went out to look at it discovered that they found four drilled holes, actually more than four. Mm-hmm. And what it was somebody had obviously put in an electromagnetic driver and had accelerated this to come and give us a kiss in the third orbit, which no one had the capability to do. They knew how they could look back and they'd say, no one was out there. No one was even. So we know two things. You think, well, first, you know, actually a couple of things. And this is where the story starts and why it starts out as a sort of skullduggery and whodunit, because it's not broadly released for a variety of reasons. But behind the scenes, what's going on is people know, okay, we got to get out there because somebody just tried to take us out. Mm-hmm. But why would they do it and be so circumspect about it? Huh? I wonder if they don't want to be caught, which means it's not just one group out there or one. It's somebody who doesn't want to be caught by somebody else. They don't care about us. So what do you have? You have somebody's playing around in our system. If they're not here, it may mean that FTL is actually possible. It means that we better get out there and do something about it. And it means that it's not just probably one species or whatever, but at least two and maybe more. And once again, what that does is the ones who tried to take us out, well, what did they do? They kicked off our renaissance. Stuff we were not willing to fund is what actually leads to the beginning of that story. It's not just the law of our unintended consequences. It's I think that's going to prove to be a, unless any species has perfect wisdom and foresight, we're all going to grapple with that. So that's, I'd say, the common point.
Okay. Which kind of leads me a little bit into my next question. How much science do you feel you can describe without it becoming the dreaded info dump? Or are readers so scientifically literate these days that describing the science behind the story becomes unnecessary?
I'm going to dodge that either or, because it's not what's going on in my mind when I do it.
Okay.
First of all, I do the science, and I take a page from Heinlein's book, not Clancy's. Clancy is a great person for, I think, if you want to, as an inspiration or a mode, not for his characters, but in terms of a sort of gritty, you are there feeling. Clancy does, and technothrillers in general do a great job with that. And that's what I aspire to as a vibe. But when it comes to story construction, Heinlein is the guy who basically said, you go into somebody's house and he says, you want to watch TV. He doesn't give you a dissertation on what the magic box is and what it does. You just, it's there and it does it. Mm-hmm. If it is foreseeable enough, you have probably less, it is less incumbent upon you to structure the story so that why that thing could exist in a broad, how that happened, if it's connected to us in a historical sense, we probably want some hints. You know, they don't have to be engineering hints, but they have to be hints of investment, interest, whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. And we have to find some way, if it's going to violate physics or whatever, you know, egregiously and dramatically, the more it does that, the more we probably have to explain it, which is why the only thing that gets explained in the first book, and it's not done as an info dump exactly though, is that FTL, that superluminal drive. But I go at info dumps in the following way. I know they're coming, and I say, what will make the transmission of information not feel like an info dump? And the answer to me, this is a pattern. You can find this pattern very, very flagrantly and oft used in my books, which is put two people on opposite sides of a coin on that they are arguing over, no, that's not the thing to do. Yes, it is the thing to do. And you build the components, the defense of their various points are the features which either explain the technology or point off stage to what that technology clearly assumes. Mm-hmm. Like I say, I do the math, so you don't have to. Actually, frequently, I talk to people who do the math, who then give it to me, so I don't have to.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds way better than the more traditional method is have somebody that understands the thing and have them talking with somebody who doesn't understand the thing, and they're simply lecturing them in a boring way, kind of, to fill them in. Yeah, have them argue about it.
Yeah. And I had to do that a little bit in that scene, but what's happening is the leader of the delegation who's going out to meet whatever might be behind this entire phenomenon that almost took us out of the greater evolutionary mix of the universe, is annoyed because the genius doesn't want to deign to explain things.
Hmm.
And so he doesn't like the way she constantly is criticizing him. So he says, well, you know, it's this. And this makes her feel like, okay, so what does that mean? And so what's actually going on is he's digging her.
Mm-hmm.
And he's also, he's probably someplace on the spectrum, right? And has
the autistic spectrum. The autistic spectrum.
Well, yeah, we're all someplace on the electromagnetic spectrum, after all. But
no, I mean the autistic.
Yeah. Spectrum. Yes. Exactly.
Okay.
And he has challenges of one form or another, and one of them is that he has not insufficient empathy for what she's trying to do, because she's trying to do make she is there predominantly from a cultural, social standpoint, political standpoint of smoothing waters. And he has this sort of contempt for the fact that really this thing is going on and you don't understand any more than this. So I'm going to make you stupid, look stupid in front of all these other people. And that becomes the big, because there's another guy who's looking at this, who says, Jesus, if I don't find a way to make him back off, we're going to melt down before we even get to where we need to do what we need to do. Hmm. So the conflict, while that conflict is going on, all the pieces of the drive are essentially revealed.
Okay.
Are you a fan of space and traveling from planet to planet? Great! If you would like to get your company advertised on our podcast and video series, you can reach out to us by emailing us media@irg.space. The Interstellar Research Group has many sponsor benefits ranging from lunar to intergalactic. Be sure to mention that you would like to get your company promoted in the From Here to the Stars podcast and video series. That email address is media@irg.space. media@irg.space. And be sure to check out our website, irg.space, for more information. Thank you, and have a stellar day.
Let's see. Early in your career, you wrote a book by the title Hard Times, published by Game Designers Workshop for the science fiction role-playing game Mega Traveler. Describe it, if you would, and how did it come about?
So actually, Traveler was the first place that I published professionally. I had been paid for television work for 5 years prior to that. But this was the first time I ever actually, even before fiction, I had seen this game growing up. A lot of your viewers are going to know Traveler. I assure you of that. Its creator, Mark Miller, is a dear friend of mine. We still are doing sort of, there's this project we have in mind that we keep on trying to get to, but we're both very busy. And this was a very came out in 1977. It was pretty much the first role-playing game of any note. It was certainly the first science fiction role-playing game after the Dungeons and Dragons sort of wave hit in 1973, 1974. But it was entirely different. You design things. There was a planetary generation sequence, which was, really simple, but elegant in that. The amount of science that informed it, the amount of qualitative grounding it had in what you could make your own universe. You didn't have to use their universe, but the first three books were the one and a half of them was essentially how to, and it measured anything from how would you represent all creatures, all life on some kind of quantitative spectrum. How would you represent, as in all RPGs, humans in terms of their attributes and skills and things like this? How do you represent what is the relationship between a stellar body and the sort of number of planets it's likely to have around it? There was the sixth book that came out was called Scouts. I will tell you why, neither here nor there, but the greenhouse effect was included in the equation based on Kelvin to be able to determine based on hydrographic percentage, ice caps, and therefore influence on albedo, density of the atmosphere, the type of star, how close it was to the star. And greenhouse effect was all there to tell you, to boil down to, is that going to be 15 degrees C average, or which side of it, or how far, and where, what therefore is going to be on that planet? What's it going to be like? You were talking now, I think, 1980. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this just captivated me. And it you can probably hear, the reason I went into this is, first of all, shout out to Traveler, shout out to Mark. Mm-hmm. But also, it quantified storytelling. It didn't make the act of the narrative itself, the human interaction, that was left to us. But there was always this ruler, you know, mm-hmm. in the background that was like, does it make sense? Are you being consistent? Are you breaking the rules you yourself have set? And by the way, in this system, we tie a lot of them to physics. And when they broke physics, they told you when and why and how to facilitate the game. Well, that really drove me. And Hard Times was so I started writing for Traveler and their magazines, 1988. I was brought on as they sort of shuffled control of it out of house. And I was brought on as sort of one of, as technically they called me the Mega Traveler guru. Now, Mega Traveler was in many ways a weaker version, I would say. There are going to be people who, now you may get hate now. than original Traveler. But what had happened is they had created this empire operatic scope that they just wanted to reduce. So they knocked it over with the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And in it, you know, this huge star-spanning empire collapsed into wild areas, and it was, no one had dealt with it. And they realized this was not a great thing. So Hard Times was, they said, I proposed to show how that resolves. Now, it was at first very unpopular with a lot of people. Some people loved it. But the reason is because you take a star-spanning empire and you go civil war. And now you start using WMDs on strategically important planets. And you have asteroid colonies that are never going to be able to be self-sufficient, particularly if they're lower tech. You have people dying in the billions. And I didn't want that to happen off stage, like some battle in an Italian light opera. If you're going to actually pile up bodies like Cord Ward like that, the narrative reality of that environment, I felt, had to have at least one work that sort of nodded at, this ain't all fun and games, boys and girls. Mm-hmm. So that was that project. And now it seems to be it's many people's favorite product from that entire line. Mm-hmm. But at first it was a big sea change. Mm-hmm. The mood had always been very upbeat and this, that, and the other thing. And I think they thought I was going into some sort of post-apocalyptic dystopic thing, but my attitude is, no, we got to get through this to get to the other stuff, but we just can't leave this unremarked.
Okay. It has long been confirmed that there is water frozen at the south pole of the moon. It is located in the shaded base of craters where the warmth of sunlight has not touched for billions of years, possibly many cubic miles of ice. How valuable for the future of humans in space would it be to get our hands on that water?
Right now, most people don't even understand probably the significance of that question. IRG, of course, does. Mm-hmm. I think it is pivotal. It is, to my mind, probably the equivalent of, there we are, we're going across, we're going out of Pennsylvania, we're going past Ohio, but we know already from down Louisiana way, there's this thing called the Mississippi River. And if you can get to that, you're near the Great Lakes, you're near the Gulf, you're out to the Atlantic. One day you're gonna drill down through Panama, and you're going to be able to get the entire world in your backyard through that one artery. I see water on the moon, and also vents on the moon. I mean, look, there are a whole lot of questions about living on the moon for any extended period of time, and I don't mean to get into them here, but when you don't have an atmosphere and you don't have a rotating molten iron core, you're going to need something against the rads. And these really lovely, aesthetically pleasing visions of surface domes and things like that. I look at that and I say, what, like a 20 minute every 2 years? Because the rads are going to be punishing. And do you get enough warning on the solar weather? But those tubes, please. I would also see the same thing for Mars. I think that where we have these sort of these vents, and it would be a lot easier to seal parts of them to make those hermetically sealed than, and you get automatic radiation shielding. And so that, but the water, well, let's see, you know, and it's water right next to silicon. Wow. Silicates. If you were, how can I put this? Because it's there, it doesn't look unusual. But if that wasn't the case, and we just had, let's say, Deimos and Phobos, Mars moons floating around up there, in addition to the fact that we wouldn't have the tides we have, there would be also, and a lot of other things, but where would we have a convenient gas station with all the components to put in a charging station? Really? Really? I mean, if I did that and we all lived with Deimos and Phobos overhead, people would say, oh, well, that's convenient. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's that pivotal. The water is whether you're talking about for reaction mass, whether you're talking about for drinking, whether you're talking about for breathing. I mean, it's all right there. Then you generate electricity to crack the water. Please. Too easy. So yeah. I know I'm preaching to the choir, but I cannot answer that question emphatically enough. And the last footnote on it is 250 years from now, people are going to be teaching kids why that was so important. The reason that we have to teach kids today why the Mississippi was the absolute change point. It was the inflection point in the development of the New World, and well, at least North America.
We are at 1 hour, so let me go to my last question.
Well, I'm trying to keep up here with the Jerry Purnell, you know. I gotta
No, that record may stand forever. I don't know. I've only interviewed five. Yeah,
for you and your viewers' help.
I've only interviewed 500 people, and I think it'll stand till at least 1,000. In the future, half a century from now, what is your vision of human exploration of space? Where do you envision that we will be living and working, and how will this transform human civilization?
That is an excellent and kind of depressing question on which to end, because I think right now, if we remained in boom times, and I think that if we I have so many thoughts on this matter because
no doubt
you can tell, I'm not exactly I'm probably a little bit above a layman on the level of familiarity with the relevant topics. Mm-hmm. I don't think the answer is going to be the gold and the platinum and the silver that's in the asteroid. Simple reason: inflation. You bring it home, value is determined by rarity. Yeah, it's great to have all that stuff. I have rarely seen anybody say, okay, now inject all that into our world and our economy, and what happens to rarity and what happens to the value? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's visionary thought with a wide root to one of those laws of unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. Because what happens if you go there for that reason and then the economy breaks? Now people are saying, we should have never gone to space. You got to have the right reason, mm-hmm. and it's got to be sustainable. I think energy is actually, and I don't mean the big floating, you know, solar panels that O'Neill sort of made as the validation for the L5 stations. But the bottom line is there's an awful lot of energy out there. There's an awful lot of raw materials of all kinds out there. I won't go into all of the ways that I think you could commercialize space very, very easily and very valuably. My worry is that take a look at COVID, take a look at inequities on our own planet. And this really touches on the thing that makes me do much of what I do. I love writing. I would do it anyhow, but I do it because I think it's important. Space is that challenge, which will ask, we can't leave anybody sitting on the bench, particularly if, I mean, it's only a matter of time before something maybe smaller, maybe bigger than what hit Tunguska comes along. What are we going to do? Do we really want as much of our globe in poverty? Do we really want educational levels so low? I'm not an idealist. I'm not thinking that we can just simply mint money and all things are going to be well. But I do feel that in order for, you want an existential threat, to use this new context of a word that I associate with Camus. If you want a real existential threat, you have nothing but to do. People say, why do we need to worry about this? I say, is the moon out tonight? Go look. There are your answers. All those dots, those are your answers. Sooner or later, we have an appointment with something. And the bottom line is, let's be proactive. Let's get out there sooner. And to do that, I really think you need many more people wanting to pull in that direction. And I don't think we have that yet. And I think part of the reason, part of what we need to do to get over that, is to reduce inequity. When people are worried about how they're going to fill their bellies, or now if they're going to get clean water, or, you know, it's between getting seared or getting flooded, they're not going to be thinking about, it's like, I got to live now. Talk to me when I'm alive 2 years from now and my belly hasn't been empty. Maybe we can talk about that other stuff. So I don't think it's the technology. I'm very, very optimistic about the technology. I think that our will is being pulled in a valid way in many other directions. I think the fastest way to get to space, I know this sounds counterintuitive, you keep doing the stuff that people like Musk are doing and people like Bezos are doing. I give a shout out to a company that got really savaged, I think, in the press unfairly, Astra. And I mean, they had that unfortunate, did they get it up? Yeah, you could see as soon as you were looking in the monitors, planet space, planet space, planet space. Well, I don't think that fairing came off, Blaine.
I just watched that yesterday.
Pardon me?
I just watched that video yesterday.
Yeah, and it's like, and you hear the people who know in the room going, oh, because they knew what had happened. Mm-hmm. But you know, and I'm giving you an example of how money gets in the way of space. That system, 4.5 feet wide, 43 feet tall, microsats, take it any place in the world with a concrete surface that you can put that, up. Mm-hmm. And it got savaged in the press. Why? Because it's not as big and it can't carry a ton. And they're talking about all the other ones that are out there. I'm sitting there and I'm saying, yeah, you left out two things. You can launch it every day for $1 million. And at $1 million a pop, what is the cost per kilogram? Interestingly, all the short sellers who went after Astra failed to mention that. And this is, you know, part of the problem is all the inequity. Part of the problem is greed that will not spare a stock or a vision that is actually, I mean, listen to Musk talk. Whatever you think of him as an individual, unless you think he's deluded and or making it all up, he really understands the Tsiolkovskian proposition of let's get the heck out of the cradle because it's the only way we can be sure of going on. So what I think is we need will. I think the technology is going to come along. I see so many hopeful things in technology, from everything from closed bio loop to better thrust agencies. My God, you guys know, my guess is almost everybody who's going to watch this knows. If the NERVA project had been allowed to progress in the early 70s all the way through, I'm not so sure we wouldn't be having this conversation beamed back and forth between Europa and Mars. Mm-hmm. Because Heinlein did the math a long time ago. If you can do something like 0.01G for days, and all you need is reaction, any gas will do, mm-hmm. any liquid will do. You're flying tea kettles, you'll own the solar system. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. I don't doubt the technology. And I think we have better options on rotational habitats than anybody's aware of. I think there are also opportunities. We didn't get into one of the things in my fiction, which is cryogenic suspension, which people say, oh, well, you're really breaking the rule now, am I? Mm-hmm. I mean, Arctic cod freeze solid. Back in our genes, when you go back to Chordata, you're going to find something that basically changes the glycerin levels in our bloodstreams as essentially antifreeze. You take a body down to 32.5 degrees and you re-engineer their own blood to go in there and give it a month so it perfuses throughout the entire body. Most of the problems you have with, and this is another case where I called up Rob Hampson, who you'll know, mm-hmm. Dr. Rob Hampson, who's IRG, I'm sure. And he actually did a piece. I asked him to do a piece set in my fictional universe about that, where that's all laid out, right down to the fact that you'd need to keep the brain active occasionally because you might lose memories if you don't keep the theta waves going. Okay. So you'd live, but you get up and you don't remember anything. So I do as much hard science fiction as can be done inside of the box in which I play. Mm-hmm. And I absolutely think that the best case 60 years from now, we're on Mars. We make a false start on the moon because the fast way is not going to be the enduring way. That's why I talked about the tubes. Mm-hmm. The tubes will be a permanent answer, but the tubes are going to require a bigger engineering solution and a bigger infrastructure. But man, once you've got them, you know, the only thing now you're worried about is living in that low G and what it does over an extended period of time. But I could see answers to that too. You know, every week, do you have to take the equivalent? Because here's another thing, beanstalk on Earth, you know, the cable car, so to speak, to orbit. I don't know about that. And I don't know that you could get anybody who'd want to be in the tumble print of that. But on the moon and even Mars, now you're talking about shuttle up. You go to a rotating gym and you have to live there for if you want it enough. The answers are all out there. I really do believe that. But we have to want it enough. And I think enough of us have to want it. And right now there are too many people who just want to be able to see their kids live.
Okay. Well, thank you, Doctor. I appreciate you taking the time for the interview. It's great stuff.
Thank you very much. It was a great fun being here. Hopefully everybody's ears will recover from all the bombardment they got from all my very opinionated and perhaps only partially informed opinions. But it was great. It was great to be here. Thanks for having me on. I'd love to come back. And everybody in the IRG, hello. I was there when it was still TVG. And if I have the time, I definitely want to come back and say hi and see what's going on and be a part of it.
Excellent. That was Dr. Charles E. Gannon. This has been the podcast version of the YouTube series, From Here to the Stars, which is created by the Interstellar Research Group. The IRG is a nonprofit organization dedicated to thoroughly exploring the science and engineering that can eventually open up the reality of interstellar travel. Find out more about our next symposium at irg.space. I have been your host, Stephen Ewan Cobb. If you enjoyed this video, please hit the like button, and you can subscribe to our channel for other such videos. On behalf of all of us here at the Interstellar Research Group, I thank you.